This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Charlotte Rampling is making a comeback after a long bout of depression that prevented her from acting for several years. She started her career in England in the mid-60s. Her best-known films include Georgie Girl, The Damned, The Night Porter, Zardoz, Farewell My Lovely, Stardust Memories, and The Verdict. For the past 25 years, she's lived in France. She plays an English woman living in France in the new French film Under the Sand. When the film begins, Rampling's character, Marie, is driving with her husband, Jean, to their summer home. There are long silences on the trip, and after their arrival, Jean seems detached. Soon they go to the beach. Marie takes a nap while Jean prepares for an ocean swim. She wakes up to find he's disappeared. Viewers are unsure if Jean has drowned, committed suicide, or walked out on his wife. Marie is unable to accept any of these possibilities and carries on as if he's expected back momentarily. In this scene, she meets her friend Amanda at a restaurant. It's months after Marie's husband has disappeared, but she's still talking about him in the present tense.
So how are things?
Okay. I'm just a bit tired.
Why don't you come to spend this weekend with us in the country and rest up?
Hmm? What about Jean? I'm worried about him.
What do you mean?
I'm just wondering if...
If what?
I'm just wondering if he's not thinking about suicide.
You mean, you think that Jean might actually have committed suicide last summer?
I don't know. Amanda, if you knew anything about him, you would tell me, wouldn't you?
Of course I would. You're my best friend, Marie. But now it's time to forget. There's no point going over it again and again. You have to carry on, Marie. You have to live for yourself.
Charlotte Rampling, welcome to Fresh Air. The part in Under the Sand was written for you by the director and screenwriter François Ozon. Did he tell you why he wrote this for you, why he sought you out?
I think he wanted a woman, an actress, but also a woman who was prepared to delve very deeply into all different areas that are not necessarily very comfortable, without being inhibited and without wondering what she necessarily looked like, without wondering about the fact that she was acting or not. He wanted it to be more of an experience, the whole film. And I think the way that I work has quite often been like this, and I think that's what he picked up on and was very intrigued by and wanted to sort of take it a step further, really.
Now, my understanding is that you shot the first part of the movie, and then François Ozon, with your input, wrote the rest of the movie. So the first part of the movie takes you up to the point where the husband disappears. Did your interpretation of the first part of the movie change as you participated in the writing process of the second part of the movie? Did you get different ideas about what this couple's marriage was like, what kind of person your character was?
Well, I think in a way, by living quite a while, because between those two periods ended up being, well, a bit longer because we had money problems, it ended up being about 5 months. So during those 5 months, I didn't work on another project. It was very much about really trying to understand and be in that situation, but not necessarily in a conscious way, but just somehow, you know, like living in your dreams with the idea of this kind of loss, which I'd actually personally been through way back with my sister when I was 20, and probably had never really come to terms with, because you don't really very easily come to terms with grief. Nobody knows really how to grieve. Some do it better than others. But in our five-month period of that writing period, we had an awful lot of time to find out about Marie and about who, you know, who she meets and who can help her and how she actually comes through.
What happened to your sister?
My sister died when she was 23 and I was 20, quite suddenly, I mean very suddenly, a brain hemorrhage. And so the shock sort of ricocheted throughout our family, and my mother didn't really recover. She just died recently, but she sort of, some huge part of her died when my sister died, and she never really recovered. So she was unable to come to terms with it. And she was a broken woman. And I, you know, as a younger girl, just sort of got on and lived my life, but realized when I was doing this film, all sorts of things came through to make me, I don't know, understand, or just to put things to rest, let's say.
Did you draw on your mother's reaction, too? Because you witnessed, you not only experienced your sister's death from, you know, from your point of view, but you saw your mother be totally broken by it.
Yes, I suppose so. You see, I suppose I was able to do this film in the way that I did it. And it seems that it's come across quite powerfully. And I think probably the only way I wrote was able to do it, because I've lived through all that for so many years. And it sort of haunted me, you know, for many, many years. Because you don't really know what to do about it, and you put it away, and I banished it and pretended. You pretend, and you go into denial like Marie does, and you say, well, I mean, it's happened, but I'm not going to think about it, you know. I'm not actually going to think of what it means, and I'm not going to go into that darkness. But actually, you end up having to. And you end up having to in rather odd ways. So I didn't... The actual grieving process that Marie goes through is condensed in a quite a short period of time, which is really quite healthy, because it can go on for sort of that sort of... can drag out for a very, very long time when people cannot come to terms with the death of somebody. And if it does go on for a very, very long time, it becomes very... how should I say? Very... debilitating for the person, because you're sort of like held in some kind of grip, you know. It's like until you actually go towards the dead, you can't actually let yourself live. It's a very, well, we all know it's a complex
thing. Sounds like you're describing the last scene of the movie.
Almost, probably, yes. Yeah, the last scene in the movie is very much that, and it's swinging to and fro.
Charlotte Rampling is my guest, and she's starring in the new film Under the Sand. You were born in England in 1946. Your father was a British colonel who became a NATO commander. What did he do in World War II?
He was a gunner in the Royal Artillery, and he was posted to Malta.
So you grew up just after the war in England. Did you have vivid memories about the war through what your parents told you?
No, because my father never spoke of it. And it was very true about a lot of people who had been through the war. People didn't speak about things like that in those days. So I never knew. I never knew anything about anything that my father had done, because he wouldn't tell me. And I still don't.
You must feel like there's a whole part of him that you don't know.
There is. And he, you never know, because it might just all come out and just before he dies. When I say all come out, that's, you know, in a way that's rather a romantic illusion. But he is beginning to talk now. Since my mother died, he's beginning to talk, which is really quite extraordinary. So you never know. You never know until somebody dies what they will reveal.
I don't know if your father talked to you about this, but he won a gold medal in the 400-meter relay in the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. This is the Olympics that was documented in the Leni Riefenstahl movie Triumph of the Will. Could you see him in the film?
Yes, oh yes. I mean, I only knew about that through somebody else who told me that they'd seen my father in a film and that he'd won this medal. I mean, that's as much as he's, you know, boxed into his isolation. And so then I found out and I said, Dad, I'm sending you a film that you're in. And then we started to break down. He started to break into it, and I tried to talk about it a bit, and he talked about it a bit. But it's the most beautiful film, and he runs like a guard because he had to catch up a race that the runner before him was losing because he was ill, Frank Wolfe. My father was in the second lap of the relay, and it's an extraordinary race. And the BBC recorded it too as one of the most outstanding athletical feats, and he won a record for that race. He held a record for many, many years for running, absolutely. And then after that, I think he stopped because he ran so well that I think he couldn't bear it and he had to stop. They're strange people, the men of those years.
Did you have a strict upbringing? Was he strict with you?
Yeah, but although I resented it, I'm quite glad I did have a strict upbringing. I like that.
You were also educated at private schools. Were you educated to be a very proper young British woman?
Yeah, in uniform and proper and learning, you know, with the manners of English girls at that time and all that. But I sort of, in my way, I rebelled in my heart against it, but I knew that it was building some strong fibre in me, and it had, because it's given me, it's given me a very fine structure and a sense of discipline, which actually does only help in life yourself. You don't have to impose it on others, but you can, if you have it somewhere in the fibre of your soul, from your education, it's not a bad thing.
Were you told before you started acting that you were beautiful, and did that make your life any better, any easier? Were there any surprising complications from that?
No, because I don't think you really sort of do know that you're beautiful in a funny way. I know this sounds odd again, but if you ask any young beautiful woman, they sort of, you just want to be part of the pack, actually, at that age. You just want to be, you just want to learn how to grow up and not be too, and not be taken out and sort of be shown that you're too different. I mean, that's how I felt.
But usually, you know, the assumption is being really attractive increases your stature, makes you more liked, more popular.
Yeah, it does.
More everything that young girls want to be.
Yes, but I knew that I didn't deserve it, and it wasn't anything to do with me. So I knew from a very early age that I should never play with this as some kind of weapon because it didn't belong to me. And it was useful. It could be useful. And it sure has been useful. And I've had fantastic years knowing that I'm beautiful. But I was also terrified about the whole, why did people like me more than my friend who was less beautiful? Why did I get the advantages? Why was always I asked out to parties and they weren't?
Were there things you really wanted to be noticed for that you felt you had more earned, that were more about your talents or your personality?
Well, you think so, but you don't quite know at that age. You think, you know, there must be other, you know, there are other things, deeper hidden things that you want to learn about as you grow older and as you grow up. Deep things that you feel that are your value, your own personal unique value, that only belong to you as a unique individual. Being part of a collective, but just almost on your own, and beauty is something that gives you pathways into all these fields if you want to. But I've always felt I've really beaten myself up about it in a sense that I felt that I really had to earn it. That's all. And but then if I'd been ugly, it would have been the same thing. I'd have fought as hard to be accepted, and just because I'm not good looking, you know what I mean?
Yes,
it's that the battle is the same.
All right.
The battle actually is the same, but the supposedly the beautiful ones have the luckier, you know, have the luckier coin.
My guest is Charlotte Rampling. Her new film is called Under the Sand. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress Charlotte Rampling. She's starring in the new film Under the Sand. So you started making films when you were 17. Mm. You were 20 when your older sister died of a brain aneurysm, so you already had several films that you made. So just as you were, you know, becoming a star and entering into this exciting world, your sister died, and so you were in this kind of increasingly glamorous world at the same time you lost her. There must have been, well, just an incredible contrast between the world you were entering and the grief that you were feeling.
Yeah, and that's when I stopped making fun pictures. I was having a lot of fun. I was really having fun for 3 years, sort of my life. I really had fun. I mean, I'm not saying that I didn't, you know, haven't had later on, but much later on. And the guilt was just terrifying, you know, when somebody dies, and especially with my mother almost, you know, beside herself with grief. You just say, I can't make fun films anymore. So that's when I went into the darker side and did, you know, films. I sought out films that psychologically were much more painful.
Well, let me get to one that's probably about as dark as it gets. This is a film you're very famous for, the 1974 movie The Night Porter. Mm. And you play a concentration camp victim who, several years after the war, you meet up with a Nazi who abused you in the camp, and you both start up a very disturbing kind of sadomasochistic sexual relationship. The Nazi is played by Dirk Bogarde, who you also work with in 1969 in The Damned. How did you feel about taking this role? I mean, this is a role that some people would describe as very dark. Other people might describe it as disturbing. Others might call it kind of sick. You know, it's pretty
it's
heavy
about,
role.
Yeah, it's about forbidden things, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's about areas that we don't often really want to go into and analyze and think about and turn over and look at. It's about, you know, it's about the deep, dark fantasy world that, you know, perhaps we dream about, but we don't really want to admit it. And I think the reason I took this film, I've lived on a very instinctual level, and my choices are sort of just, you know, grabbed somewhere inside. Because if you start to analyse why you would do Night Porter, and I just had a baby who was my first son, who was 3 months old, and when Dirk Bogarde called me, because I'd worked with him in The Damned of Visconti before, and when he called me, he said, look, I've decided to do this film after 5 years, because I turned it down 3 times. I've decided to do this film. There's only one girl that can do it, and I won't do it with anyone else but you. They wanted Romy Schneider at the time, who was a bit much bigger star. I wasn't a star at all at that time, so I didn't, you know, didn't wield any money or power or name. But when Liliana Cavani saw me with Dirk, she said that was it, and there was a kind of fascinating thing that happened with Dirk and I around this subject. Dirk, for his reasons from the war and the pain and the horrors that he'd lived through the war, and me for what I'd been through on a personal basis. And so, you know, again, that was what we put into the film.
What did you think of as your character's motivation for entering into this relationship with an unreformed Nazi?
Well, she was abused and couldn't do anything else like abuse children. She was very young, she was 16. And when she saw him again, it was the only thing that she'd ever really, had really ever deeply affected her, whether it was love, whatever it was such an, it was so affecting to her, this experience that she had when she was 16 in the camp, that when she saw him again, she could not resist it and had to go plunging back into that darkness.
There's a very provocative scene in The Night Porter in which you're singing a very sultry cabaret kind of song in a room of Nazis. You're moving around the room slowly and evocatively, wearing baggy pants which are held up by suspenders, and the suspenders are the only garment that you're wearing from the waist up. Mm. Would you describe filming this scene?
Well, strangely, as films are, this film, that scene was the first scene I had to make in the film. And I arrived, and I not only had to learn the song, the German song of Marlene Dietrich, an old song of hers, but we also had to, you know, learn what we were going to do in this very sort of evocative, tragic scene. And it was the first thing we did. And you just do it.
Leben, liebe ich zu leben. Ich kann nur sagen, ich liebe zu gefallen, wenn auch nicht immer, liebe ich zu lieben. Ich weiß nicht, was ich will und dort erwarte viel.
That's Charlotte Rampling singing in a scene from the 1974 film The Night Porter. So what was the experience like of making a film that's this dark and this sexually dark? I mean, was it a disturbing experience for you to make the movie?
Yeah, but yeah, completely disturbing. Mm. Completely disturbing. But you sort of put yourself on hold, you know. There's an odd technique that you have in this business is you put yourself sort of slightly in denial about a lot of stuff, because otherwise you can't really do it.
Right.
And you know that you can command your body into action to do it absolutely as you want to do it, but your mind is not quite connected to what you're doing. Your mind is somewhere else.
Had you sung much before this movie?
No, just like everybody, you know, singing away. And you do in voice classes, too, that I'd taken. There was singing, you know, singing lessons and how to project your voice. So I had worked on it. But the voice had to be very bad, really. It had to be not too good. It had to be the terrified, sort of strange voice of a 16-year-old singing under duress. And also, but also in a way, getting sort of a bit high on it. So there was all that mixed in.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I had read that you had considered singing when you were in your teens, but your father didn't want you to be a singer because it meant wearing short skirts at cabarets. I laughed so hard when I saw that, because this is your singing debut here.
Yeah, that's actually, that's Very interesting you bring this up. I just hadn't thought about it. Absolutely true.
It's like his nightmare come true. He was worried about you wearing a short skirt, and here you are, like, you know, wearing nothing but suspenders and pants.
Right. A more decadent debut could you have? Not.
Precisely. Did he ever see the movie?
Well, he said he'd never seen it, but I found out that he had, but years and years and years later. And I wonder, actually, if he really had, anyway. But we don't talk about my films at home. Well, my mum doesn't, because she can't, but my dad never talks about my work.
It's
one of the subjects that we don't talk about.
Right, I got it.
But he's talking, as I say, he's coming out now a little bit, and he's really beginning. I mean, he was interested why I went to America and what is this film, you know, Under the Sand, first time we've ever actually talked about it. And this is since my mother died, interestingly. It's quite strange things unlock, don't they? You never know. And so he's now talking a little bit about them, and he's realizing a little bit what I've done in my life, and he's saying how proud he is of me and things like that. So it's really moving.
My guest is Charlotte Rampling. Her new movie is called Under the Sand. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Charlotte Rampling is my guest. She's starring in the film Under the Sand. You know how you were saying after your sister died, you really wanted to take roles that weren't like funny and entertaining, but roles that were in dark films, because that was the mood that you were in. Did you at some point move away from that and feel that you could do entertaining or funny films again? They didn't have to just be about darkness.
Well, that came later. You see, that came, I would say, in my late 30s, really. When I decided not to make any films at all, because it just wasn't, I mean, I just, all this wanting to go into the darkness through films had been extraordinary, and I'd learnt a lot, but I'd come to a dead end. And I then sort of had to go into my own particular world. And then when I came out of that, I suppose that you can call that the depressive time, right? So when I come out of that a few years later, then there was much more fluidity and choice, and yeah, and now films can I don't know where they'll lead me, but I'm much freer to be able to choose now. I have that choice.
Are you saying you went through a period of depression where you didn't even want to work?
Yeah, but that was very necessary too, obviously, on the kind of journey I was on. If you look in retrospect, I just had to go, you know, had to go into that too, and just shut down, and then, you know. And then you learn other things which bring you out, and on you carry on.
How long was that shutting down period?
Well, it wasn't a complete shutdown all the time, but a complete shutdown for about 3 years, and then it sort of eased and eased and eased, and then you realise that you're coming into the light and you're able to actually begin doing things and connecting with the world and all that, and then it becomes, you realise that you're on, you know, you're coming back into yourself, really, because you just completely lose yourself. It's really like dying, I suppose, in a way.
Was this in the 80s and the 90s?
This was in the 90s, yeah, yeah.
So one last question. When you were going through your depression, were you confident that you'd come out of it and that you'd eventually work again?
No.
Right. It sounds like it went on for
but
a few
you
years.
But you know, you have two options, don't you? To somehow come through it, or to take your life. You have two options, and that's why depression is a very serious thing, because you do have the option. A lot of people take the other option. I didn't. You know, there'd been enough death in my family, but I didn't know whether I'd come through, because it just, you know, you have no idea.
Right.
But I think most people do when I don't know the sort of the numbers of it, but you do somehow. I don't know how, and there's all sorts of different ways, but you do come through. But it takes an awful long time. There are various degrees, you know. There are various degrees, there are various intensities too. Some people is much milder than others. Yeah, thank goodness.
You know, people always wonder, if you're talented, if you've made, you know, if you're a movie star and you're beautiful and you have money, how could you be so depressed, right? Like, why, when you have so many gifts? I think some people find that incomprehensible. But it seems like it's just kind of beyond all that. It's something more internal than that.
Yes, because you see.
That.
Yeah, because you see, it's about your soul, it's about your spirit, and your spirit doesn't know about all that, and your soul doesn't know about advantage, you know, advantages in this world, the wonderful advantages that I have been given, of beauty, of, you know, and children, and a career and all that. Your spirit and your soul doesn't know about that, and that's what we're talking about. Your spirit is yearning so, so deeply and is in such pain and you don't know why, and that's what you somehow... It's not having to find out, but you just have to nurture it and just to hope that, you know, you will come back wanting to live again.
Well, it's great to see you in movies again, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
That was very nice. Thank you. Thank you for talking to me.
Charlotte Rampling is starring in the new French film, Under the Sand.